Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Russian reunification. 70 years on, scars from the Civil War are finally laid to rest in a ceremony hailed by political and religious leaders alike. The politics of fear. A new human rights report calls for stronger global solidarity to halt the undermining of basic human freedoms. But first, Pope Benedict looks back at his recent pastoral visit to Brazil during his weekly general audience. Thank you for joining me. A great nation with profoundly Christian roots, but also with enormous social and economic problems. That's why the Church must mobilise all her spiritual and moral forces in order to work together with others for solutions to these problems. At his general audience on Wednesday, Pope Benedict recalled some of the highlights of his recent visit to Brazil for the opening of the 5th General Conference of the Bishops of Latin America and the Caribbean. His words were greeted enthusiastically by a huge crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square, as my colleague Ema McCarthy reports.
The burning May sun shone on St. Peter's Square Wednesday morning as pilgrims and visitors in their summer best welcomed Pope Benedict XVI back to the Vatican after his sixth apostolic voyage to the Latin American continent, and more specifically to Brazil.
I thank all of you for your prayers during my visit to Brazil.
Indeed, in taking a break from his series of lessons on the early fathers of the Church, the Pope revealed his highlights of the trip, which he began by describing as a pilgrimage of praise to God for the faith of the Latin American continent, which he said has shaped the culture there for over 500 years.
My recent pastoral visit to Brazil embraced not only the great nation, but all Latin America and the Caribbean, home to many of the world's Catholics. While we do not overlook the various injustices and sufferings which accompanied colonization, the gospel has expressed and continues to express the identity of the peoples in this region and provides inspiration to address the challenges of our globalized era.
Pope Benedict then went on to dwell on those pastoral appointments and events which touched him most. Above all others, his meeting with the continent's lost youth in the Farm of Hope.
In the Fazenda da Esperança, a network of centers for young people recovering from drug addiction, I saw a symbol of that spiritual recovery which our world truly needs. A recovery of our dignity as God's children, and a reconciled relationship with all creation. The canonization of Brazil's first native saint, Fray Antonio de Santana Galvão, reminded us that holiness is the real revolution which brings about authentic reform in church and society.
And of course, the culmination of the papal journey, the opening of the 5th General Conference of the Bishops of Latin America and the Caribbean in Aparecida, where still today they are gathered, discussing how to inspire the continent's Catholics to become convinced disciples and missionaries of Christ and of his love.
After my joyful meeting with the young people, I am confident that they will be apostles to their contemporaries, use their rich gifts in the service of the new evangelization, and ensure a future of hope for the Church in Brazil and in all Latin America. May God bless you all.
Wednesday evening, Pope Benedict is guest of honour at a concert here at the Vatican, where the sacred tones of the Resurrexi, performed by the Verona Arena Orchestra, will round off a fitting welcome home for the music-loving Pope. I'm Ema McCarthy.
And my thanks to Ema for that report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday general audience. Political and religious leaders in Moscow have hailed the recent healing of divisions within the Orthodox Church as a vital step forward for the whole nation. On May 17th, the Feast of the Ascension, Moscow's Orthodox Patriarch Alexei II and the head of the New York-based Orthodox Church Abroad, Metropolitan Laurus, signed a reunification document during a televised ceremony in the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour. Russian President Vladimir Putin was among those attending the ceremony. He said this religious reunification was a key condition for rediscovering the lost unity of the whole Russian people. So-called white Russian exiles, who supported the last Tsar Nicholas II and opposed the Red Army, set up the Russian Church Abroad after losing the civil war and fleeing their country in the 1920s. The breakaway church moved first to Turkey, then to Serbia, but later set up its headquarters in the United States. After the fall of the communist regime in the 1990s, talks began on the reunification process, in which President Putin played a significant role. Geraldine Fagan is Moscow correspondent for the Forum 18 news agency, which monitors religious rights across the former Soviet bloc. She attended that reunification ceremony in the Russian capital.
The patriarch arrived at around 9:30, and just before him, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church Abroad, Metropolitan Laurus, first of all, the act of canonical communion was read out in the presence of numerous bishops from both churches, all dressed in white. And then the two heads of the churches signed the act of canonical communion, and Patriarch Alexei gave a short speech, basically saying what a wonderful occasion it was. And that was followed by a short speech by President Putin. In Patriarch Alexei's speech, he stressed the importance of the fact that President Putin was an Orthodox believer, and how this had helped to secure the trust of the hierarchs of the Church Abroad.
Now, you follow these issues very closely. How much do you agree with that analysis? How much is this quite a political issue beyond the obvious religious and spiritual overtones?
It is to an extent. I mean, for example, behind me, as they signed the act, one man said, now this is the end of the civil war. So for many people, it really is. After 70 years, people are no longer seeing Russia in terms of white monarchist and red communist. They're seeing it as a real, as well as spiritual, as a process of unification, obviously, on a spiritual level as well.
So for President Putin, this is quite an important event for him to be able to oversee this historic occasion.
Yes, obviously, it puts him in a very good light. It shows him as breaking with the past, of also helping to restore Russian tradition, Russian greatness. It certainly enhances his status.
But not everybody is happy with this reunification. There are many who don't actually like the idea of the two churches joining up together again. Tell us a little bit about that and why, what the reasons are for those being against it.
Yeah, there are, both within Russia and abroad, there are groups in both churches who are not happy with the process and haven't been, obviously for many years, happy with the idea of contact between the two churches. But as far as I'm aware, all the bishops in the Russian Church abroad have supported ended up supporting the process. So I think it's reasonably small grouping. Certainly within Russia, it's a very small number of parishes. I mean, there were only something like 100 parishes of the Russian Orthodox Church abroad within Russia anyway, and those parishes have mostly decided that they'll join back with the Moscow Patriarchate.
Is this going to mean any practical changes in the life of Orthodox believers, or is it really more of just a very historical occasion, charged with a lot of significance, but nothing very much in practical terms?
Well, obviously it means that priests of both churches are going to be able to celebrate the liturgy together. For many years, those believers who felt that they are part of each other's churches have actually in practice been obviously intending, say, a church, a broad church, if they go outside Russia or vice versa, unofficially. I mean, that practice has basically been allowed. And I know certainly, a case of people getting married, even though they're from the two separate churches. So, in fact, I would say for the life of the ordinary believer, it's probably not really that big a change. But certainly for the hierarchy, it really is. Perhaps more on the church abroad side, they've had to put aside a lot of suspicions and concerns about the Moscow Patriarchate. You know, obviously specifically its links with the state, and basically the whole issue of collaboration in the Soviet period, and even to some extent ecumenism as well, because there hasn't actually been any movement on that issue within the Moscow Patriarchate. And certainly I think some people in the church abroad would have hoped maybe for that they might be able to get the Moscow Patriarchate perhaps to, say, pull out of the World Council of Churches as a condition of the reunification. But that, in fact, that hasn't actually happened.
And so where do you see this going in terms of the ecumenical dialogue? Because, as you say, the church abroad, the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, has been very against ecumenical dialogue, very suspicious of contacts, including contacts with the Catholic Church. So what do you perhaps see the consequences of this in terms of future dialogue?
Practically, it may have little difference, because the Moscow Patriarchate is quite a variated organism, and there's different parts of it that have been able to do quite different things simultaneously. So, for instance, you've had the whole commission dealing with the issue of reunification with the church abroad, and then separately you've got the Department for External Church Relations carrying on its dialogue with Lutheran churches in various places, and also the Catholic Church. So I would expect that to continue. But I think in general, even without the whole reunification process, I would say that the mood within the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate, is gradually becoming less interested in the whole ecumenical process anyway. So if there is a kind of cooling of relations with other churches, I would say that is actually part of a process that's been continuing. It's not necessarily something that's been influenced by the reunification with the church abroad.
What would be the other reasons then for this cooling off that you're talking about?
I'd say simply a lack of interest. I mean, there's basically a lack of interest at a grassroots level within Russia in contact with other churches. I mean, largely because non-Orthodox churches are still, I mean, a very small minority within Russia. And so, by and large, Russian Orthodox people can just live their lives without actually coming into contact with non-Orthodox people. So it's not really a very relevant issue for most people. So I think because of that, that sort of translates into a lack of interest at a higher level.
As you heard there, the Catholic Church in Russia remains a tiny minority of the population, but its principal spokesman, Archbishop Tadeusz Kondrusiewicz of the Mother of God Diocese in Moscow, also hailed this event as an important step forward for the whole Christian community.
It is a very significant moment for the Russian Orthodox Church because of this event, its closing. A very long period, about 90 years of division between the Orthodox Church here in Moscow and Orthodox Church abroad. And all kind of unification always is a good sign. It gives new prosperity, it gives new hope for the Orthodox Church. Also, the voice of the Orthodox Church now will be more stronger than it was before. It will be stronger all over the world. And it will be stronger also defending Christian values. And in this sense, it will be also, I think, very useful regarding relationships with the Catholic Church, because of, in front of challenges of the modern world, in front of these dangers of these challenges, we are alliance. We have the same mind, and our teaching practically is the same, and that's why it's important. And also, now there are a lot of Russians abroad, and this unification, I think that will help also for the Russian Orthodox Church to provide pastoral care of these people who leave Russia, who are staying abroad.
And yet many people in the Russian Orthodox Church abroad are quite against the idea of ecumenical dialogue, of better relations with other churches. What is this going to mean for the dialogue with the Catholic Church?
Well, I think this time of confrontation now is finished. And today we understand that in front of these challenges, in front of difficulties of the modern society, it is a time to repeat Shakespeare's question, to be or not to be, to be or not to be for Christianity. And we must feel, all Christians must feel this responsibility, our common responsibility for the future of Christianity and for evangelization of people. And I think that this unification, this case, this event which happened here today here in Moscow will be helping us.
Archbishop Tadeusz Kondrusiewicz heads the Mother of God Diocese in Moscow. And earlier you heard Geraldine Fagan of the Forum 18 news agency. Amnesty International on Wednesday released its 2007 annual report on the state of human rights in countries around the world. The 320-page report makes somber reading, with its detailed documentation of torture and killings, trafficking and imprisonment, rape, repression and discrimination of all kinds. Above all, it warns of efforts by both governments and armed opposition groups to foment fear, to erode human rights, and to create an increasingly polarized and dangerous world. In response to this alarming trend, Amnesty's Secretary General Irene Khan says there must be a stronger sense of global solidarity and a focus on the universality and indivisibility of human rights.
The erosion of human rights can only be arrested if there is a stronger sense of global solidarity, if there is an end to this politics of fear, a sense that there is real value in human rights, that the world, a fractured world, can be brought together around global values of human rights, around the universality of human rights and the indivisibility of human rights.
In her introduction to the report, Khan recalls the four freedoms spelt out by US President Franklin Roosevelt in his vision of a new world founded on freedom of speech and religion, freedom from fear and want. In contrast to that, Amnesty says far too many leaders today are undermining those freedoms by engaging in the politics of fear.
Governments are prepared to water down basic human rights, sometimes justifying it on the issue of war and terror, but on the other, simply downplaying, undermining basic human rights again.
Tawanda Hondura is an Africa specialist at Amnesty's London headquarters. He told me more about the concerns contained in this annual report.
Governments are actually using the rhetoric of fear to terrorize and target opponents and also to target those that are critical of their policies. This is also seen within the context of the war on terror, largely spearheaded by America and also governments largely within Europe. But this has been transposed, and within Africa, there are war and terror-related human rights violations, again, through the peddling of fear. And in countries such as Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Cameroon, to name but a few. So it is a concern for Amnesty International that governments primarily are using fear to violate basic human rights.
The report says that these politics of fear have led to a world which is as polarised now as it was during the Cold War and in many ways more dangerous. Doesn't this really undermine all the work and all the interest in human rights protection that we've seen over the past few decades?
It does, and one way in which this can be seen is, for instance, to give a precise example, is the way that torture is being sought to be undermined or downplayed, where, for instance, methods of coercion, which previously would have been classified or actually currently classified as torture, there are attempts to undermine and weaken them. But regarding, I think, in Africa, similar rhetoric, similar fears are being played upon by governments in Africa, some of them which have for a long time been violating human rights, but have now found legitimacy or justification by looking at what is happening elsewhere in the world, particularly with the war on terror. So I think to answer your question in a nutshell, the answer is yes. What's happening currently is severely undermining general awareness on human rights and all the efforts of people the world over to ensure that human rights are observed and upheld.
Now, the report points out that fear grows out of short-sighted and cowardly leadership. But given that politicians are always interested in their short-term voter support rather than long-term interests, perhaps, isn't your message destined to fall on deaf ears?
Well, we hope not, because what has led the world after the World War II were issues to do with principle. There have been instances, obviously, when adherence to human rights principles have been undermined. But at the end of the day, principle, what is right, has always triumphed. So our call as Amnesty International, which is, again, purely on principle, is to urge the world, to urge governments to ensure that they hold sacrosanct that which is contained in, you know, the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and all the international covenants that most of the United Nations member states actually signed to and ratified.
Your report focuses especially on women who are particularly targeted by these policies of fear. Where would you say is this most prevalent? Where are you most concerned about? And why is there relatively little attention, do you think, to this problem?
Well, women tend to be the ones that are mostly affected by violations of human rights and also by conflict coming out of, or which is the result of, again, the governments or armed opposition groups using fear to undermine stability and undermine security. And to give an example, which is within Africa, one finds that in most of the IDP and refugee camps in Chad, in Sudan, it is mostly women that are there. It is mostly women that are grossly affected. Rape is used as a weapon of war in the conflict that engulfs Darfur, the Darfur region of Sudan. So, and this is just but an example. There are other numerous examples that one can point to, again, within the continent of Africa and beyond, where women are the primary targets, suffer the most. But, however, on the other hand, do not receive the same level of publicity or recognition that they are suffering as a, you know, as a group.
You're talking about the situation in Darfur, for example, where the international community has expressed a high degree of outrage at what's going on there, and other countries in Africa as well, and yet seems to be powerless to have any impact on its leaders to stop using oppression and terror or else step down from power. What else can you do here?
Well, there's a lot more that can be done, and one of what can actually be done by the international community is to maintain pressure on the government of Sudan in order to ensure that it accepts the deployment within Darfur of a hybrid African Union and United Nations force. Amnesty International holds that to be, at the moment, the single most important vehicle to ensure that violations of human rights are actually stopped. In addition, we also call upon the government of Sudan to stop directly attacking people and also indirectly using the Janjaweed militia to attack people and commit human rights violations. Your question is, what can the international community do? They can continue putting pressure. They are putting pressure but there needs to be bite to the buck at the moment. Amnesty International has constantly called upon key regional countries to ensure that they continue putting pressure. If they put pressure, it will take away the lie which has been peddled by the Sudanese government that the situation in Darfur has been exaggerated by the West. So in order to take that away, there is need for greater involvement, greater engagement, particularly by the League of Arab States countries.
For a stronger sense of global solidarity and a focus on the global values of human rights. What exactly do you mean by this?
The world needs to ensure that they hold dear and uphold basic human rights, including economic, social and cultural rights, as opposed to a trend we're witnessing at the moment. So what Amnesty International is calling for is basically for governments to uphold the principles that, again, they signed, you know, after World War II, and which have influenced most of the discourse, resolution surrounding conflicts that have affected countries around the world and also particularly in Africa.
This call for global solidarity and a focus on the universality of human rights and human dignity, it echoes much of the language used by the Vatican's own Justice and Peace Council and indeed by the Pope himself. Do you see the Church as an important partner in this fight to be free from fear and oppression?
Yes, indeed. The Church is an important institution within, and that's not just the Catholic Church, but religions of all manner in countries around the world. Religion does play a part within people's lives, and oftentimes religion provides the moral compass that influences society, that influences how people view human rights and how people clamor or call for their own governments to observe and uphold human rights. So, yes, indeed, churches around the world, religions around the world do play an important part in ensuring that human rights are actually upheld, and more particularly that human rights are indivisible, that you cannot divide economic, social and cultural rights from the civil and political rights. You know, each goes with the other. And most countries that are affected by conflict, one can actually find the causes or the drivers of that conflict within violations of economic, social and cultural rights, which ultimately leads to violations of civil and political rights. So in a nutshell, yes, I would say yes, the Church and religions the world over do play a part, have a role to play.
And my thanks there to Tawanda Hondura, Africa specialist with the global human rights network Amnesty International. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.